Holly researched the background of all her clients in order to better anticipate their requirements. With this one, she had taken special care. The word in the marketplace was that, despite appearances, Garrick Courtney was a formidable presence and had already demonstrated his acumen and courage by procuring the Shazaville title and a controlling interest in Alpha Centauri estates. Her accountant had drawn up an approximate list of his assets, which included, along with his property interests, considerable equity in blue-chip gold companies and the Courtney mining shares, which he had acquired from his family when he was appointed to the board of that company. More significant was the prevailing view that both Santon and Shaza Courtney had given up on his brothers and decided that Garrick Courtney was their hope for the future. He was the heir apparent to the Courtney millions, and nobody knew the sum total of those. 200 million? 500 million? Not inconceivably, a billion rand. Holly Carmichael shivered slightly at the thought. As she watched him now, she saw not a large, bumbling young man in steel-rimmed spectacles, who made an expensive suit of fine wool look like a bag of laundry, and whose hair stood up in a startled tuft at the crown. She saw power. Power fascinated Holly Carmichael. Power in all its forms. Wealth, reputation, influence, and physical power. She shivered slightly as she recalled the feel of the muscle under his sleeve. Holly was 32 years of age, almost 10 years senior to him, and her divorce would count heavily against her. Both Santon and Shaza Courtney were conservative and old-fashioned. "They'll have to be good to stop me," she told herself. "I get what I want, and this is what I want, but it's not going to be a pushover." Then she considered the effect she had on Garrick Courtney. She knew he was besotted with her. The first part would be easy. Without any effort at all, she had already enmeshed him. She could enslave him as readily. After that would come the difficult part. She thought of Santon Courtney, and all she had heard about her, and she shivered again, this time with neither pleasure nor excitement. Garry stopped in front of her. Although their eyes were on a level, he now seemed to tower over her as he glowered at her. A moment before she had felt herself perfectly in control. Now suddenly she was uncertain. "I've seen what you can do when you really try," he said. "I want you to try for me. I don't want second best. I just don't want this." Holly stared at him in amazement. She'd not even contemplated his rejection. Certainly not in such brutal terms. Her shock persisted a moment longer and then was replaced with anger. "If that is your estimate of my work, Mr. Courtney, I suggest you find yourself another architect," she told him in a cold fury, and he didn't even flinch. "Come here," he ordered. "Look at it from this angle. You've stuck that roof on the shopping centre without any regard to the view from the houses on this slope of the hill. And look here. You could have used the fairways of the golf course to enhance the aspect of these flagship properties instead of shutting them off the way you have." He had taken hold of her arm, and though she knew he was not extending even a small part of his strength, still the potential she could feel in his fingers frightened her a little. She no longer felt confident and patronizing as he pointed out the flaws in her design. While he spoke, she knew that he was right. Instinctively, she had been aware of the defects he was now exposing, but she had not taken the trouble to find the solutions to them. She had not expected somebody so young and inexperienced to be so discriminating. She had treated him like a doting boy who would accept anything she offered. Her anger was directed at herself as much as at him. He finished his criticism at last, and she said softly, "I'll return your deposit, and we can tear up the contract." "You signed the contract and accepted the deposit, Mrs. Carmichael. Now I want you to deliver. I want something beautiful and startling and right. I want something that only you can give me." She had no answer, and his manner changed. He became peculiarly gentle and solicitous. "I didn't mean to insult you. I think at the least you are the very best, and I want you to prove me right. Please?" She turned away from him and went to her drawing board at the end of the room, slipped out of her jacket and tossed it over the desk and picked up one of her pencils. When the pencil poised over the blank sheet, she said, It seems that I've got a lot of lost ground to make up. Here we go. And she drew the first bold, decisive line across the sheet. At least we know now what we don't want. Let's find out what we do want. Let's start with the shopping centre. He came to stand behind her and watched in silence for almost 20 minutes before she glanced back at him with the violet eye glinting through the veil of shining blonde hair. She didn't have to ask the question. Yes, he nodded. Don't go away, she said. When you are near, I can feel your mood and judge your response. He took off his jacket and threw it beside hers over the desktop. And he stood beside her in his shirt sleeves, with his hands thrust into his trouser pockets and his shoulders hunched. He remained absolutely still, his concentration monumental, and yet his presence seemed to inspire her to tap the mystical springs of her talent. At last, she saw in her mind how it should have been, and she began to rough it out, her pencil flying and flicking over the sheet. When the day faded, he went to close the curtains and switch on the overhead lights. It was after 8 when she at last threw down her pencil and turned to him. That's the feeling I want to give. You were right. The first attempt wasn't worthy. Yes, I was right in one other respect. You are the very best. He picked up his jacket and shrugged it over his massive shoulders, and she felt a tingle of dismay. She didn't want him to go yet. She knew when he did she would feel exhausted and spent. The effort of creation had drained her resources. You can't send me home to begin cooking at this hour, she said. That would be the sadistic act of a truly cruel taskmaster. Suddenly all his confidence evaporated, and he blushed and mumbled something inaudible. She knew that she would have to take charge from here. The least you can do is feed the slave. How about offering me dinner, Mr. Courtney? She created her usual stir of masculine interest as she preceded Gary into the restaurant, and she was glad he had noticed. She was surprised by the aplomb with which he discussed the wine list with the maître, until she remembered that Weltevreden was one of the leading wineries of the Cape of Good Hope. During dinner, their conversation was serious, and she was relieved not to have to endure the usual banalities of a first date. They discussed the Sharpeville crisis and its implications, social and economic, and she was amazed at the depth of his political insight, until she remembered that his father was a minister in Favut's cabinet. He had a ringside seat. If it wasn't for that Prince of Wales check suit and those ghastly steel-framed spectacles, she thought, and the crest of hair that makes him look like Woody Woodpecker. When he asked her to dance, she had misgivings. They were the only couple on the tiny circular floor, and there were a dozen people in the room she knew. However, the moment he put his arm around her waist, she relaxed. Despite his bulk, he was agile and light on his feet, with an excellent sense of timing, and she began to enjoy herself. Until abruptly his dancing style changed, and he held her differently. For a while she was puzzled. She attempted to maintain the close contact of hips which had enabled her to anticipate his moves, and only then she became aware of his arousal. She was at first amused, and then, despite herself, intrigued. Like the rest of him, it was massive and hard. She played a little game of brushing lightly against him and withdrawing, all the while chatting casually and feigning total ignorance of his predicament. Afterwards he drove her in the MG to where her own car was parked. She hadn't ridden in an open sports car since her university days, and the wind in her hair gave her a nostalgic thrill. He insisted on following her Mercedes back to Bantry Bay, to see her safely home, and they said good night on the pavement outside her apartment block. She considered inviting him up for coffee, but her sure instinct warned her to protect the shining image of her that he so obviously had conceived. Instead, she told him, "I'll have some more drawings for you to look at by the end of the next week." This time, she put everything of her talent into the preliminary sketches, and she knew they were good. He came to her office again, and they worked over them until late, and then dined together. It was Thursday night, and the restaurant was half empty. They had the dance floor to themselves, and this time she worked her hips lightly and cunningly against him as they moved. When she said good night outside her apartment block, she asked, "I suppose you will be at the Met on Saturday." The Metropolitan Handicap was the premier horse race on the Cape Turf calendar. "I don't race," Gary replied reluctantly. "We're polo people, and Nana, my grandmother, doesn't approve of me." He stopped himself as he realized how callow that sounded, and he ended, "Well, somehow I've just never got round to racing." "That's about time you did," she said firmly, "and I need a partner for Saturday. That's if you don't object." Gary sang all the way home to Velterfrieden, bellowing happily into the rushing night air as he drove the MG through the curves and dips of the mountain road. It took Gary a while to understand that the actual racing was not the main attraction of the meeting. It was secondary to the fashion show and the complicated social interaction of the racegoers. Amongst the bizarre and outrageous creations that some of the women wore, Holly's floating blue silk and the wide-brimmed hat with a single real pink rose on the brim were elegant and understated, but drew envious glances from the other women. Gary discovered that he knew nearly everybody in the members' enclosure. Many of them were friends of his family, and Holly introduced him to those he did not know. They all reacted to the Courtney name, and Holly was subtly attentive, drawing him into conversation with these strangers until he felt at ease. They made a remarkable couple. Beauty and the Beast, as one of the unkind wags suggested, and a buzz of gossip followed them around the ring. "Holly's been out cradle-snatching, and Santon will have her burned at the stake." Gary was totally oblivious to the stir they were creating, and once the horses were brought into the ring for the first race, he was in his element. Horses were part of the life at Velterfrieden. Shaza had carried him on the saddle before he could walk, and he had a natural eye for horse flesh. The first race was a maiden handicap, and the betting was wide open, as none of these two-year-olds had raced before. Gary singled out a black colt in the parade. "I like his chest and legs," he told Holly, and she checked his number on the card. "Rhapsody," she said. "There has never been a good horse with an ugly name, and he's trained by Miller and ridden by Tiger Wright." "I don't know about that, but I do know that he's in peak condition and he wants to work," Gary told her. "Just look at him sweating already." "Let's have a bet on him," Holly suggested, and Gary looked dubious. The family strictures against gambling echoed in his ears. But he didn't want to offend Holly or appear childish in her eyes. "What do I do?" he asked. "You see those gangsters standing up there?" She pointed at the line of bookmakers. "You pick any one of them, give him your money and say, 'Rhapsody to win.'" She handed Gary a 10-rand note. "Let's dib 10 each. Gary was appalled. 10 rand was a great deal of money. It was one thing to borrow 2 million on a legitimate business scheme, but quite another thing to hand 10 to a stranger in a loud suit with a cigar. Reluctantly, he produced his wallet. Rhapsody was in the ruck at the turn, but as they came clear of the bend, Tiger Wright steered him wide and then asked him to run. The colt jumped away and caught the leaders in front of the stand, where Holly was hopping up and down and holding her hat on with one hand. He was 2 lengths clear at the post, and Holly threw both arms around Gary's neck and kissed him in front of 10,000 beady eyes. As Gary handed over her share of their winnings, she said, "Oh, wouldn't it be fun to own one's very own racehorse?" He phoned her apartment at 6 o'clock the following morning. "Gary," she mumbled, "it's Sunday. You can't do this to me, not at 6 o'clock.
"This time I've got something to show you," he said, and his enthusiasm was so infectious that she agreed weakly.
"Give me an hour to wake up properly." He drove her down to the curving beach of False Bay beyond Musenberg and parked at the top of the dunes. 40 horses with their apprentice jockeys and grooms were cantering along the edge of soft white sand or wading bareback in the curling green surf. Gary led her down to the group of 4 men who were supervising the training and introduced her. "This is Mr. Miller." The trainer and his assistants looked at Holly approvingly. She wore a pink scarf around her forehead, but her thick blonde hair fell freely down the back of her neck, and the short marine pea jacket emphasized the length and shape of her legs in the ski pants and calf boots.
the trainer whistled to one of his apprentices, and only when he turned the colt out of the circle of horses did Holly recognize it.
"Rhapsody!" she cried.
"Congratulations, Mrs. Carmichael," the trainer said. "He's going to do us all proud."
I don't understand." She was bewildered.
"Well," Gary explained, "you said it would be fun to own your own horse. And it is your birthday on the 12th of next month. Happy birthday."
She stared at him in confusion, wondering how he knew that date and how she was going to tell him that she couldn't possibly accept such an extravagant gift. But Gary was so rosy with self-satisfaction, waiting to be thanked and applauded, that she thought, "And why not? Just this once. The hell with conventions."
She kissed him for the second time, while the others stood around and grinned knowingly. In the MG on the way home, she told him, "Gary, I cannot possibly accept Rhapsody. It's much too generous of you." His disappointment was transparent and pathetic.
"But," she went on, "I could accept half of him. You keep the other half, and we'll race him together, as partners. We could even register our own racing colours."
She was amazed at her own genius. A living creature, owned jointly, would cement the bond between them.
"Let all the Courtneys rant and rave. This one is mine," she promised herself.
When they reached her apartment, she told him, "Park there next to the Mercedes," and she took his arm and led him to the elevator. Like her office, the apartment was an expression of her artistry and sense of form and colour. The balcony was high above the rocks, and the surf crashed and sucked back and forth below them, so that it seemed they stood on the prow of an ocean liner. Holly brought a bottle of champagne and two tulip glasses from the kitchen. "Open it," she ordered, and held the glasses while he spilled the creaming wine into them.
"Here's to Rhapsody," she gave him the toast.
While she made a huge bowl of salad for their brunch, she instructed him in the art of mixing a dressing for it. They drank the rest of the champagne with the salad, and then sprawled on the thick carpet of her living room floor, surrounded by books of silk samples, as they discussed their racing colours, and finally decided on a vivid fuchsia pink. "It'll look beautiful against Rhapsody's glossy black skin," she looked up at him. He was kneeling beside her, and her instinct told her that this was the precise moment. She rolled slowly onto her back and hooded those bi-coloured eyes invitingly. But still he hesitated, and she had to reach up with one hand and draw his head down to hers, and then his strength shocked her. She felt helpless as an infant in his embrace, but after a while, when she was certain that he would not hurt her, she began to enjoy the sensation of physical helplessness in the storm of his kisses, and let him take control for a while, until she sensed that he needed guidance once again. She bit him on the cheek, and when he released her and started back in surprise and consternation, she broke from his grip and darted to the bedroom door. As she looked back, he was still kneeling in the centre of the floor, staring after her in confusion, and she laughed and left the door open. He came in like a bull at the Cape, but she stopped him dead with another kiss, and holding his mouth with hers, unbuttoned his shirt and slipped her hand into the opening. She was unprepared for the thick pelt of springing dark hair that covered his chest, and her own reaction to it. All her other men had been smooth and soft. She believed that was her preference. But now her sexual arousal was instantaneous, and her loins swam with excitement. She dominated him with her lips and fingertips, not allowing him to move while she undressed him. And then, as the last of his clothing fell around his ankles, she exclaimed aloud, "Oh, dear God!" and then caught his wrist to prevent him covering himself with his hands. None of her other men had been like this, and for a moment she felt uncertain of her ability to cope with him. Then her wanting overwhelmed any doubts, and she led him to the bed. She made him lie there while she undressed in front of him, and every time he tried to cover himself, she ordered him, "No, I like to look at you." He was so different, all muscle and hair. His concave belly was rippled with muscle, like the sand on a windswept beach, and his limbs were clad in muscle.
She wanted to begin, but she wanted even more to ensure that this would be something that he would never forget, that would make him hers for all of his life. "Don't move," she whispered, and naked she stooped over him. She let her breasts swing forward, and her nipples just brushed the curls on his chest, and she touched the tip of her tongue to the corner of his eye, and then ran it down slowly to his mouth.
I've never done this before," he whispered hoarsely. "I don't know how." "Shh, my darling, don't talk," she whispered into his mouth. But the idea of his virginity elated her. "He's mine," she told herself triumphantly. "After today, he will be mine forever." And she ran her tongue down across his chin, down over his throat, until she felt him thrust up hard and thick between her dangling breasts, and then she reached down and took him in both hands. It was darkening in the room when at last they lay exhausted. Outside, the sun had sunk into the Atlantic and left the evening sky infuriated by its going. Gary lay with his cheek cushioned on her breasts. Like an unweaned child, he could not get enough of them. Holly was proud of her bosom, and his fascination with it amused and flattered her. She smiled contentedly as he nuzzled against her. His spectacles lay on the bedside table, and she studied his face in the half-light. She liked the big virile nose and the determined line of his jaw, but the steel-framed spectacles had to go, she decided. Those and the Prince of Wales checks, which emphasized the squatness of his body. On Monday, her first concern would be to find out from Ian Gantry, her partner, the name of his personal tailor. She had already chosen the pattern. Crisp grey or distinguished blue, with a vertical chalk stripe that would make him taller and slimmer. His reconstruction would be one of her most challenging and rewarding projects, and she looked forward to it. "You're wonderful," Gary murmured. "I've never met anybody like you in my life." Holly smiled again and stroked his thick, dark hair. It sprang up under her fingers. "You've got a double crown," she told him softly. "That means you are lucky and brave." "I didn't know that," he said, which was not surprising, as Holly had invented it as she said it. "Oh, yes," she assured him. "But it also means that we have to grow our hair a little fuller over the crown. Otherwise it will stand up in a tuft like this." "I didn't know that either." Gary reached up and felt his tuft. "I'll try that. But you'll have to tell me how long to let it grow. I don't want to look like a hippie." "Of course." "You are wonderful," he repeated. "I mean totally wonderful."